This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, Justine Toe from the Centre for Public Christianity digs deeper into the Noah film starring Russell Crowe. What does it say about the character of God? How do they frame the environmental message? And should Christians be concerned if Aronofsky's interpretation of the story differs from their own? The AFL has decided to remove scoring, ladders and best and fairest from the game for kids under 10. They're hoping to increase the focus on just having fun. Our family expert, Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au, shares what the research says about whether kids really enjoy competition. Catherine Leary-Alsdorf from the Centre for Faith and Work in New York was in town recently. She talks about her experiences as a CEO in Silicon Valley and says we can expect to find meaning in our work if we're doing it for the right reasons. And finally, Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review showcases the online fashion company Shopo and the unconventional entrepreneur at the helm of the successful online business. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. Well, the story of Noah may be famous around the world, but thanks to his Noah blockbuster, the name Darren Aronofsky is almost as well known. The Hollywood director's interpretation of Noah has been welcomed by some Christians, but derided by others. His portrayal of God, his environmental themes, and his understanding of the ancient story are all points of contention. But do they need to be? Justine Toe is a cultural commentator from the Centre for Public Christianity and one of our film reviewers. Hi, Justine.
Hi, Katrina. Great to be with you.
Yeah, now I have to admit, I haven't actually seen the film, but what do we learn about the character of God from watching this movie?
Well, I saw it. It seems to me that the God that Aronofsky is portraying is one that is very strong on judgment, but mercy seems to be not a very big priority with him. That's the overall kind of assumption that I came away with. But I think as well that, you know, the film, as it's called Noah, it's told from the human and limited perspective of the character. So you could almost say that Noah has perhaps misinterpreted God's overall desire to show mercy through saving the lives of his family.
Okay, so Noah thinks that God wants to wipe out
humans entirely. Okay. Yeah, whereas you could just argue that perhaps he's misunderstood, you know, okay, what God's really going on about, because the biblical text is very clear that this is what God is ultimately trying to do. He is showing judgment, sure, but it's not just judgment by itself. His judgment is always mixed in with mercy. I think perhaps today people have that attitude that God is very much about judgment, and he's not a soft character that would be interested in mercy. But hopefully people who are believers, when they have conversations with their non-Christian friends, can at least, you know, draw out the distinctions between Aronofsky's God and the God that we see in the Bible.
Now, there's also really strong environmental themes throughout this film. That's been another talking point. So how is humans' relationship with the environment portrayed in the film?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if you're a non-believer, then you probably could emphasize the film's environmental messages and sort of downplay the other themes that we see in the film that stress the wickedness of people. Or as a believer, you could say that, oh, perhaps because the film's too green for my liking, but we don't get enough on the wickedness of people.
Right.
I think what we need to do in this case is to understand that the mistreatment of the world and the fact that people have filled the world with violence both stem from the same root. So the idea that people have rejected God, basically. And you see that through the characters of Tubal Cain, who's played by Ray Winston, and Noah. Noah is interested in sustainability and also in walking with God in righteousness, whereas Tubal Cain wants to dominate the world and bend it to his will. And he uses that kind of attitude to exploit creation and to do what he wants with it, basically.
Okay, so it's sort of portrayed in a way that caring for the earth is another aspect of our relationship with God.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think that the film is very clear that the wickedness of people is why you see people mistreating the earth as well as killing other people. You see Noah standing in soil in one of his visions, and the soil is drenched with blood, which I think is a really very powerful image. I think it in some ways references the earlier murder of Abel by Cain, which obviously is in the backstory of that. But it also can reference how humans have destroyed the earth, and there's a very there's a real cost to that violence, where the blood drenches the soil. So I think that, yeah, there are very strong environmental themes running through them, but you need to balance them alongside the other very strong theme, which is this idea that humans can be pretty rotten and they have mistreated the world and each other.
Okay. Now, there seems to be, I guess, Justin, a bit of a split of opinion amongst Christians between those who think this film has a lot to offer in terms of sparking discussion and those who think that it's a really dangerous corruption of the truth. So who owns this story?
Yeah, this is a difficult one. I think, well, you could say that the flood story appears in many different cultures, not just the biblical culture of the time. But for all intents and purposes, Darren Aronofsky is working with the biblical text, okay? So you can say that Christians and Jewish people own the story in that sense. But I kind of feel as though, does that mean if Christians own the story, does that mean that only they have a right to interpret it? And I don't think that's the case. I think that sometimes Christians can feel as though they don't want to get behind a work of art unless it will promote their own message and they have full control over the message, which I think is not realistic today because we don't live in a world where Christian voices get to determine, you know, what's good and what's bad anymore. And that's a good thing, by the way. I think that people are interested in dialogue these days and hearing from different points of view. And that's great because I think the Christian story has a lot to offer to that discussion. So I really think that there's a humility in not forcing our agenda on a text, and particularly if that text hasn't been made by an insider, let's say. I think the film Noah is fascinating for what it shows about how people understand God, and that gives people of faith a really good opportunity to share their ideas about who God is from the Bible with unbelievers. And I think we should be taking up that opportunity at every point that we can. If I think about it, you know, Jesus doesn't remain remote from us, but he actually meets us on our terms, right? So he becomes human. In a way, he opened himself up to the possibility of being misunderstood, perhaps even being rejected by other people. And so if Christians only get behind artworks that they think will allow them to control the message, it doesn't seem to be true to that spirit of Jesus, which is a vulnerable position, sure, but I think it's a position that people are much more likely to be interested in because you're not trying to force people to believe what you believe.
That's
true.
You're
happy to talk about it.
And if God can work through imperfect people, then I'm sure he can work through imperfect films as well.
Exactly.
So, yeah, thanks, Justine. Good to catch up with you.
Thanks, Katrina.
Justine Toe from the Centre for Public Christianity giving us another take on the movie Noah. The AFL is changing their approach to how kids play footy. This season, kids under 10 will play with no scoreboard, ladders or match results and no best and fairest awards. Is this the right approach? Family expert Dr. Justin Colson from happyfamilies.com.au is on the line to give us his thoughts. Hi, Justin.
Hello, Katrina.
Do you reckon the AFL's got it right with this?
I think that they do. I want to say they don't because I get really excited about competition and competition can be a lot of fun. But I think that they've got it right and the science would certainly support that. Maybe I can explain why. As much as we're a competitive culture, competition really only generally makes people happy when they're winning. You know, the top 5 or 10% of kids really love competition and they do very, very well. But we're talking here about kids who are usually, say, under the age of 10 or 12. And research would actually be more likely to support an argument that says, let's get rid of scores, let's get rid of the ladder, let's get rid of the competition and just let kids enjoy running around, kicking the ball and learning how to play the game.
And getting the skills, I guess, as well. The AFL say they're trying to encourage enjoyment from participation rather than from winning. Do you think that's a good approach?
I think that it is. There's a study that was conducted at the University of Ottawa some years ago, and I want to share it with you because I think it really illustrates why this works. There was a psychologist there. He's a sports psychologist, and he decided to change a bunch of games from being competitive to cooperative. And so what he did in one of them, as an example, musical chairs, you know, they play the music, everyone runs around and around the chairs, but there's one chair short all the time, and whoever doesn't get a chair is out. Well, what Terry Orlick, this sports psychologist, decided to do was say, we're going to remove a chair, but the aim of the game now is not to get somebody out, but to get everybody to fit onto the remaining chairs. And so after every round, another chair was removed, but all the kids stayed in. It's just that, you know, there was 10 chairs and then there was 9 chairs and then there was 8. But the whole time we still had 11 kids. And the kids had a ball because they were cooperating. And at the end, there's 10 or 11 kids trying to fit onto one chair and trying to work out how they can do it. Now, he's done that with a bunch of sports and a bunch of games, and his data are conclusive. 66% of boys prefer to play the cooperative games, the collaborative games, rather than the competitive ones. 100% of girls prefer to play the cooperative, collaborative games instead of the competitive ones. When we're talking about kids in particular, they're not interested in competition. They're interested in having fun. But we have a system that drives them into competition. And when you have a competition, winning is a mutually exclusive proposition. For one person to win, everyone else has to fail. And kids don't like that. And let's face it, a lot of adults don't like that.
Yeah. But what's your response to those who think that this is wrapping kids in cotton wool because they need to learn how to lose gracefully? Is there any kind of merit to that argument that, you know, kids need to learn how to lose well?
Well, I guess that depends on whether you're going to be consistently exposing them to competitive environments or whether you're going to try to keep them involved in collaborative experiences. We do live in a fairly competitive world, but we don't have to. We can set things up in our own families and even in our school classrooms where it's not competitive and where it's not winner takes all and everybody else loses and misses out. We can actually have a collaborative environment. Mm. When we do that, our kids are happier. They're more likely to work together. I mean, it's great for relationships when things are collaborative. It's terrible for relationships when things are competitive. So I think that the argument is disappointing more than anything, because it means that we're so fixated on competition that we don't even see that we could do something alternative.
If only we could find a collaborative way to make job interviews. You know, I mean, there are some things in life that you're going to miss out, aren't there? You know, like you're going for a job, not everyone can get it. So,
Katrina, that's a fair point, but this much I would say, we don't have 10-year-olds going for jobs.
That's right.
And there's a developmental approach here where let's let kids enjoy being kids without the competition. And as they get older, get involved in competition because we do have that kind of a world. But they don't need to learn it at 10 so that when they're 18 or 24, they can deal with it. They'll be able to deal with it when they're older because they've had the positive experiences when they're younger in a different environment.
Yeah. All right. Thanks so much. That's Dr. Justin Colson. His approach is that, it's definitely better to have fun than to focus just on winning. You can read more of Dr. Justin Colson's work at happyfamilies.com.au. What do you think? Happy to hear from you. 1300 40 2020.
I'm speaking with Catherine Leary-Alsdorf. She's the founder and emeritus director of the Redeemer Centre for Faith and Work. Now, welcome to Australia, Catherine.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure to be here this week.
I'm sorry our weather has been slightly appalling for you.
We're looking forward to getting outside today. It's a beautiful sunny day today, so thank you for that.
Now, Catherine, you have been the CEO of a number of companies, so tell us briefly, what was the highlight of your professional career?
I actually didn't seek to be a CEO, but it happened three times. I think the highlight really was taking a company that was not functioning very well internally, where there was not a lot of teamwork, there was not a lot of real focus on the customer, and trying to really bring an entirely new culture where everyone's gifts were being recognized and put to use and people were working well together, and we were really getting a lot of joy and pride at creating a product that was really going to be of use, significant use to our customers.
Mm-hmm. And how did your approach to your career change after you became a Christian?
I can honestly say that it took a very long time for me to figure out what I should be doing distinctively and differently as a Christian. So a little bit at a time, God worked on me. In the beginning, I really just wanted to not do anything horribly embarrassing to God. And so I worked on the little superficial things like my language and all those kinds of things. But over time, I think that work was a crucible that shaped me, that drew me more to God. And I think the challenges were often in how do I love the people who work with me, especially when the pressure was on, when we were trying to raise money, and if we didn't get a product out the door by a certain date, the money was all going to disappear. at those times, I could get so frustrated with the team that said they were going to do this and didn't deliver or whatever. And at some point, I started a practice of just showing up about an hour earlier and walking from cube to cube, desk to desk, and praying for each person, all 125 people in the company. And I think God just would continue to try to work on my heart so that I was there loving people instead of just using them for the purposes of the company.
Now, I know that as a woman in the high-tech industry, you did have some interesting moments, didn't you? Can you tell us about some time when you encountered, I guess, a little bit of sexism, that kind of thing? Did that ever happen?
Well, you know, in 1976, I became part of the aerospace industry. I was working as a consultant, an economic consultant to NASA. And there weren't many women at all in that industry. And so, yes, there were a number of challenges. I was extremely fortunate to work with a small group of men that invested in me. But early on, they basically wouldn't let me talk to a client without talking to them first and practicing what I was going to say. So I was groomed. I was very well-groomed. But maybe the most dramatic incident was my first business trip out without my more senior male colleagues with our very high-level customer from NASA. So I was nervous. And so here we are out to dinner, and it was the worst possible thing that could have happened. A extremely beautiful and sexy waitress comes up to our table, and she did capture my client's attention. He was just enjoying talking to her and finding out all about her life, and he was just delighting in her. And I'm sitting there feeling extraordinarily uncomfortable. And then, as she walks away, he said, "See her? She's a fox. You? You got to make up your mind. You're going to be a career woman or a fox. Right now, you're not doing very well at either."
That's a shocker. And how did you respond to that?
I was speechless. And I went home that night, and I have to tell you, I really didn't know which one I wanted to choose. But I needed the job. And the next morning, I got up and I put my hair in a bun and I put on the little tightest collar, little man-like tie I could find. And I made the decision to try to be as unfox-like as possible for the next couple of years of my career.
Well, certainly the career did sort of take off. Now, I have to say, even though you have had what people would consider an incredibly successful career, you've had some really low points as well. And I know that for a fact that one of the lowest points was when a company that you were the CEO of went bankrupt or hit the end of the road. Tell us a little bit about that experience and what you learned from that.
Yes, I took over the CEO role of a company called Pensari from the founder. So it was a turnaround. I knew that, but I felt like God had called me to it and that I had the right experience to try to pull it out. And so we worked very hard. But at the same time, the financial markets for internet companies were collapsing. So the internet bubble had burst. We eventually lined up a bunch of buyers, and 18 hours before we were to sign the contract, which would have had us sold to a company that would have kept the jobs and continued the product line and serviced the customers, the buyer backed out. The next Monday morning, I had to lay off the entire company, and we were done. And so I was just devastated. I was still a relatively new Christian. I'd only been a Christian for about 9 years at that point. I was mad at God. I thought, why do you give me things and then not let it succeed? I told you I was going to give you all the glory. Why didn't it succeed? And I really spent 6 months wrestling with God, saying, I need to understand this calling thing.
And you did have a wonderful moment that you didn't expect as well, didn't you? When you actually had to deliver the news about what had happened to the company. And you got quite a remarkable response to that.
There's no worse moment in my life than standing in front of all those people and saying, not only are we done, but I can't pay you after today. It's over. And knowing what effect that would have on their lives. And so there's, of course, this horrible dead silence after I give the news. And then eventually someone in the back of the room stands up and says, I just want to give Catherine and her management team a huge round of applause for how hard they've worked, how hard they've gotten us to work, and how we almost pulled it off. And the entire company stood up and applauded and applauded and applauded. I just didn't know what to do. It took really quite a while for me to accept what had happened, the grace that had happened in that moment. One of my staff came into my office and said, I know you can't appreciate how extraordinary what just happened was, but I want you to never forget it so that you can come back and visit it when you're ready to accept the love and the grace that was offered there.
Mm. Now, so often our work is intertwined with our identity, and whether we like it or not, and no matter how much we seek to define ourselves in God, our society does still also define us by what we do. So how do we deal with that issue as Christians?
Yes, when I left the corporate world, the technology business startup world, which is a pretty sexy kind of job to be in, I definitely enjoyed the identity that went along with that. And when I left that to go back to New York from Silicon Valley and work for a church, I was probably the most concerned about my identity. I was concerned identity first, income change second, and I guess sort of future third. It was pretty interesting. There were definitely people that were my friends before that had no interest in me once I decided to work for a church, that I would not be able to get them their next job, so no. Who cares? And so, I mean, that's always startling when you go through that. But I think that God was making me more truthful about my idols. I think prior to that, I'd said, oh, you know, I'm working here in business because God called me here. And when God called me somewhere else, I found I wasn't quite as obedient. And so it was just very helpful. It cleaned up my, I guess, internal hypocrisy that I, in fact, was liking God when he gave me what I wanted, but when he gave me something that wasn't going to be quite as cool, I was not quite as happy. So it's been a good thing. It's been a good refining process.
Now, just briefly, because this is a big question, but should we expect to find meaning and purpose in our work?
We are made to work. God created us in his image, and he gave us a mandate to go out and create culture with all the wonderful resources of this world. And yet, a few chapters later in Genesis, because of our rebellion against God, our work became extraordinarily frustrated. The question of can we be expected to find meaning in our work is a tricky one. We were made to do it, and yet it's going to be hard by definition. So I guess the easy answer is we can't expect to find easy meaning, but I think there is a wonderful sense of living out our humanity, our humanness, when we are using our gifts to the benefit of the world that we live in. We're using our gifts to God's glory. And there is meaning in overcoming some of the brokenness in the world. Or even if we can't overcome it, sometimes all we can do is stand against it. We can find meaning through any work that we're doing at any moment in time if we seek God's purposes for doing that work.
So what would you then say to someone who is feeling unfulfilled in their life or their work and they're looking to really find their purpose or their calling? How do you approach that?
I think in our culture, we too often think it's a change of job that will make us happier, when in fact it's a change of how we approach our job. Now, that's not to say that sometimes we have selected our job for all the wrong reasons, for example. We've selected a job that will pay us more over a job that we would love because we want the things that job can give us as opposed to loving the work itself. And I think in those cases, we need to really look at what's gotten us to this job and are some of those things things that are really burdening us as opposed to leading us to the work that we were built to do and made to do.
In your work with the Redeemer Center for Faith and Work, that's been a really great tool for people there. I know that we're looking at having something like that here. So how are you hoping that that would help the people of Sydney?
It's been a really fun project to help a church, in our case, create a whole series of programs that help people live out their faith more fully in whatever their work is. So I am excited that Sydney is approaching doing that with churches combining their efforts. I think that's got a lot of promise. I think the main thing is that we are attempting to help the church itself see itself not just as the church gathered on Sunday for worship, but the church is the people working in every institution in culture out there in the city of Sydney, in the country of Australia. And so I think the biggest promise is in equipping us to distinctively work for God's glory in whatever context He's called us to. The real hope for Sydney, for Australia here, is that when we mobilize all the congregations of all the churches to see themselves as the church in their place of work, we really have the potential to change the culture of workplaces from being self-serving to society-serving. We have the opportunity to honor people's gifts in a way that might not be in our contemporary culture. We have the opportunity to value human relationship in a way that often is just sort of mechanized, as we're just a cog in the wheel of making some product or service happen. So I think God wants us out there because He has a picture of what our society could be and should be that is so much more glorious than what we experience on a day-to-day basis.
Okay, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Catherine Leary Ohlsdorf. She's the founder and Emeritus Director of Redeemer Center for Faith and Work in New York City, and she's been visiting us in here in Sydney. We talked a few weeks ago about how department stores are gradually gearing up their online business. Well, a new online fashion business, Shopo, is already giving them a great run for their money with $800,000 worth of sales last December. This under-the-radar business is really getting traction with 16 to 28-year-old women, which is probably why I'd never heard of it before today. But Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review has been watching this company closely. Hi, Kai.
Hi, Katrina. I have to admit, I don't buy any of their product either. I just wanted to confirm that.
That's reassuring. Tell us a little bit about Shopo founder Jane Liu. I hear she's quite a character.
One of her mantras is, why do you need a business plan? Who came up with that rule? Now, I should point out, this is a young lady who worked for 3 years at accounting giant Ernst & Young. And she also has told me, I think people would be surprised to know how little I know about accounting and finance. You don't need a degree to run a business.
I hope she never wants a job back at Ernst & Young again after this, if this all falls over.
No, she's made that quite clear that she won't be going back. But she actually has the numbers to prove it, as you've just mentioned. And I'll tell you what she did get out of Ernst & Young. Because she was so bored and she spent so long on Facebook, and, you know, parents, you probably don't want your kids to hear this, that's part of what made her a Facebook expert, and that's essentially what is driving the growth for Shopo, or Showpony, as the site used to be called.
So the fact that there are all these, like, totally boring guys in suits... No, I'm just kidding, Ernst & Young. I actually have quite a few friends who've worked at Ernst & Young over the years, so please, I'll take that all back. But she has been very successful at using social media for marketing, hasn't she? How's she done that?
Well, it's quite simple. She has a very targeted demographic of 16 to 20-year-old young women, as you mentioned, Katrina, and she is able to talk to them because she also falls within that age group. She's just 27. All of her staff are 27, and so the culture there is pretty much all just young women that fit the target demographic. She told me she basically just posts what she would put on her own personal wall, right? So it'll be photos of herself and her friends in dresses, even just memes, you know, about Beyonce, for example. And all of these things just enable an incredibly high engagement rate. Yeah, I think we've all done this where we've followed a particular company or person or name on Twitter or Facebook and then essentially not really ever gone back. But she is able to achieve just unbelievable engagement rates. So, for example, she has 350,000 plus Facebook followers, and of those, 90,000 actually were there last week, engaging, liking, commenting, and then potentially, of course, being sent to the site to buy the product, all of which are sub-$70 dresses, basically, and other fashions.
I guess that's the other thing, you know, by keeping her prices really cheap, she's sort of really carved out this niche, hasn't she, with the younger women?
Yeah, she has. I mean, she said, look, she doesn't consider herself a competitor against Maya and David Jones. She says that Maya younger fashions, for example, she says, well, girls would find them a bit daggy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you look at these big department stores, and they've got a fair bit distance to go to catch up with social media. David Jones say they're very happy with their results, but just to give an example, not only do they have less followers than Shopo, so David Jones is, for example, around 270,000, but very few people actually regularly engage with the site. So I mentioned the 90,000 that went to Shopo last week. David Jones only had 7,000 go last week, and I wouldn't be surprised if quite a few of them were complaining.
Look, is social media a bit of a leveler then when it comes to marketing because it is an essentially free resource, or do you think that's beginning to change as Facebook's getting a lot more commercially orientated?
Look, no, that's a good point, Katrina. The face, I mean, it's social media, of course, on its face seems like a great leveler because it's free and anyone can jump on Facebook.
Mm.
However, Facebook, and they had a bit of a rocky start after they floated on the stock market, is very keen to build its revenue. So they're actually starting to bump up posts a lot more if you've paid Facebook. Now, Jane is spending a lot of money on Facebook, right? But she can't compete. I mean, David Jones spends $200 million on marketing every year, right? So
yeah,
she's going to be able to maintain that advantage because you can pay people to like your page and to shove, you know, your brand, I suppose, in people's Facebook feeds so they just think, oh, sure, I'll hit like. But it's another thing to get them going back there over and over again, and that's something that she's pointed out.
Yeah. Watch with interest to see whether you can actually have a business without a business plan. Now, Kai, before I let you go, what had you watering at the mouth on the weekend?
Well, look, Katrina, I need to give a shout-out to a Chinese restaurant called Waitan, which is in Chinatown.
Yeah.
And it's one of those fusion-type restaurants. Interestingly, rather than, you know, your Neil Perry approach of having a Western restaurant with a, you know, with Western staff but with an Asian menu, they've sort of tried to go the other way by using Chinese chefs, but then going for that holy grail of good Chinese food but also good service, which, let's be honest, is not often something that comes together. They had a rocky start, some bad reviews, but, you know, they've got a fantastic dessert, and again, Asian desserts are not something that you usually gravitate toward.
No, that's true.
Some very interesting dishes like a pork hock in pancake, and, you know, that's a little twist on the old Peking ducks.
So yeah, nice.
Definitely worth a look.
Thanks so much. It's Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review.